Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
On the one-month anniversary of the London transit attacks, the Arab satellite television network Al Jazeera is airing a new video proclamation from the second-in-command in Al-Qaeda, Egyptian Dr. Ayman al-Zawahiri. Zawahiri said British Prime Minister Tony Blair was responsible for the London bombings and promised more attacks on British soil. Joining us from London is Peter Spiegel, defense correspondent for the Financial Times. And Peter, first of all, Ayman al-Zawahiri is not to be confused with Abu Musab Zarqawi. Very, very briefly, remind our listeners who each man is.
Yes, they are very different. Zawahiri, who we heard from today, is long known to those of us who followed terrorism. He is an Egyptian doctor who actually founded his own terrorism network within Egypt in the 1990s. He was forced to flee and has joined up with Osama bin Laden at that time. He's well known to people in following this. Zarqawi is, frankly, was off anyone's radar until the Iraq war began. He is a Jordanian who we believe infiltrated into Iraq around the time of the invasion and has sort of, we believe, or at least the U.S. believes, has sort of headed the foreign fighters, the insurgency in Iraq. About 6 months ago, there was a formal statement by bin Laden sort of deputizing Zarqawi as their representative in Iraq. But he's a recent creation. He's only been prominent for a couple of years, and they are sort of from different backgrounds and different ends of the spectrum.
And as you said, Zawahiri, number two in al-Qaeda, the man who appears on the video today, does he say on that video that al-Qaeda had anything to do with the London bombings?
No, he doesn't. I think we have to emphasize that. And frankly, the way the police investigation is going here in London thus far, there has been no proof thus far that this sort of central al-Qaeda group that we sort of know rather prominently had any involvement in this. As a matter of fact, thus far, it remains a London-centric group of people either who are British or foreign nationals who live in Britain. There is no indication thus far, and he doesn't claim responsibility at this point.
Right. Well, and there's been much speculation of late that al-Qaeda has been destroyed as a central command structure. We've had conversations about that, but that the attacks, as you said, on the recent London bombings, essentially homegrown, perhaps lone operators, not associated with al-Qaeda. Perhaps they are, but I'm saying, does the tape tell us any more?
It, to be honest with you, it doesn't. Mm-hmm. It does definitely target Blair, which is the first time we've heard that in a while. It blames him for the London bombings. But most of the rest of it is the similar jargon we've heard about getting the crusaders out of Muslim lands, which we've heard. It's actually been a series of tapes that have come up in the last year or so. There's a lot of belief, as you said, there's a belief within particularly the U.S. Intelligence that group, the leadership group, is cut off. And there's a belief that this new spate of tapes is an effort to reassert bin Laden and al-Zawahiri, reassert their faces, reassert them as leaders, because the belief is they are so cut off that they really actually don't have operational control. We should emphasize, though, that at least two of the July 7th bombers did spend quite a bit of time in Pakistan last year, at least 3 months. That has led some people to believe that there is still some basic capability amongst the core al-Qaeda, leadership that may have been involved somehow. Mm-hmm. The police haven't really been able to draw that connection just yet, other than the fact that they have traveled to Pakistan.
Peter Spiegel, just a few seconds here. Anything the tape tells us about where Zawahiri is?
No, these things are always done, look exactly the same. He's standing behind a nondescript background with an AK-47 next to himself, pointing at the camera, almost identical to other tapes that he's had, and frankly, of bin Laden's tapes. They never have really any help in terms of locating or figure out where he is.
Peter Spiegel is defense correspondent for the Financial Times, speaking to us from London. Peter, thanks so much.
Pleasure.
Well, here at home, it's another day of waiting in Ohio following the deaths yesterday of 14 Ohio-based Marine reservists serving in Iraq. The U.S. military has not released all of their names yet, but it is known that almost all of the Marines were from Lima Company in the 3rd Battalion, 25th Regiment, which is based in Columbus. On Monday, 5 men from Lima Company were also killed in Iraq. 2 more from the company were killed last week, and you may recall that back in May, so-called Lucky Lima Company lost an entire squad. Well, joining us on the line from Ohio, Pat Wilcox. She's the longtime manager of the Amy Joy Donut Shop right near the battalion headquarters in Brook Park. Pat, what are people at the counter saying today? How are they taking this news?
Not good. I mean, people are very upset that so many people are dying, and it's so close to home.
Yeah. I've heard some say that they feel like Ohio's fighting the whole war.
It seems the last few days, that's what it seems like.
Yeah. Well, are they angry about the war? I mean,
yes, they are. They want Bush to get us out of there. They don't think we should be over there. But, I don't know, but then I talked to the Marines that are still here that came back, made it, and they said, well, we're making progress, so.
Boy, I guess it's a tough day at the counter, and we appreciate your speaking to us. I'm wondering, here you are at the epicenter, the center of this really sad day in
yes,
the area.
Is. Yes, it is.
What would you want to tell other Americans?
All they can do is hang in there, and God bless these parents. I'm just glad I'm not one of them.
Yeah, Pat Wilcox. She runs the Amy Joy Donut Shop in Brook Park, Ohio. And speaking of parents, we want to bring you up to date on one soldier that you may have heard about on yesterday's program when we spoke with Isolde Zirk. She runs a military family support group in Columbus, Ohio at the time. She was waiting for word on her son. Isolde called us today to say she's gotten word that her son Guy, who is in Lima Company, is okay. Well, as we said earlier, today marks 4 weeks since bombers struck London's metro system, killing 56 people. 2 weeks later, there was a failed repeat attack, and although authorities say they have no evidence of another planned bombing today, they are on high alert, with 6,000 police patrolling the city. Since that failed July 21st attack, police have arrested all four men suspected of trying to plant bombs. One of them, 27-year-old Osman Hussein, is facing an extradition hearing later this month in Rome. As we've reported, police were able to track him using his cell phone. Well, this technology has been around for years, but it's become far more sophisticated, able to pinpoint someone's location within a few feet. Joining us on the line to talk about cell phone surveillance and how it might track you, Andy Brandt, Senior Associate Editor of PC World. He writes the Privacy Watch column. And Andy, you remind us in one of your columns that this technology was used to find O.J. Simpson when he was driving his Bronco on that L.A. highway. How did they do that?
They were pioneering the use of cell phones as a radio beacon to track people down, and they tracked down O.J. by following the cells that his phone went through, and they eventually realized that he must be traveling down the freeway. And with a helicopter, they eventually spotted his car.
Yeah, Osman Hussein, the suspected bomber, was found in Italy. Now we understand that the technology has advanced. So tell us, how was he tracked down?
Well, he was tracked down in Italy probably because they had arrested several of his cohorts in the UK and presumably seized their phones and looked at what numbers they had been calling. The news this morning is that they tracked him down using the hardware code that's actually built into every phone, which doesn't change even if your phone number changes. And it seems that Hussein had been changing his SIM cards, which changes the phone number in some cases.
Those are the little chips you put in your phone with the information about your phone number.
That's right. But he managed to still be tracked, because even though the number changed, the phone number that you would dial, the phone's hardware code stayed the same.
And then now some phones have global positioning systems built into them. How do they work?
The phone itself becomes the receiver of signals that are being transmitted by GPS satellites. This is also the way that GPS, standard GPS receivers work. And they receive the signal. The phone itself decodes where it is, essentially based on those signals, and it displays it as either a map or a GPS coordinate.
So I can imagine people are listening to this and realizing, wow, people can track me through my cell phone. We can see the advantage if you can track a suspected terrorist, but what are some of the other advantages of this technology, and what are the disadvantages?
Well, some of the advantages come from some of these services that I've been taking a look at. They're called location-based services, or LBS, and a lot of phones have the ability to use them. And these can be used for a number of things. For instance, businesses can keep track of the locations of their employees during the day. So if a repairman, for instance, is supposed to be on the job and he's flaking off and going to a bar during the day, the boss can find out where he is. They're also being used to do things like keep track of how fast cars are moving on the highway. So some rental car companies are telling people that if you go over a certain speed, they're going to bill you for excessive speed while driving, and they use GPS and the cell phone built into the car to track that.
You talk about a company called Ulocate. It works with a few Motorola phones and uses Nextel service. And so tell us how that service works.
Well, the Motorola phones that are part of the Nextel service have a GPS receiver built into virtually all of them. And these are used primarily by businesses. And what has been missing for a long time is an ability to integrate in the GPS signal that the phone automatically has with mapping and other kinds of services. So, for instance, the ULocate service has something called a GPS photo service. And this is something that might be helpful to insurance adjusters or real estate people. And it lets them use their mobile phone's camera and save a picture with GPS data and a time and date. So, for instance, if you're investigating an accident or a house fire, the insurance agent would take a picture, and all of that information would be tied to the photograph.
Yeah. You write that ULocate's policy says that its service can only be used on one's own phone or on phones belonging to family members or employees, and there's an icon that comes on the screen when the tracking system is working so people know. And as you write, terrific thing for maybe nervous parents who want to give these phones to their kids.
Exactly. There are a lot of parents who want to keep track of where their kids are during the day, and kids love playing with their mobile phones, and they usually carry them all over the place. So it's a great combination to turn it into a tracking beacon to follow your kid around and make sure that they're going where they're supposed to be and they're not, you know, ditching school and going to the mall.
There might be parents who would really appreciate this, but we've been poking around on the internet and have found something that might be considered a more nefarious use of this technology. There's at least one private company that we've found that claims to be able to track anyone with a cell phone number. It's called ICU Inc. of British Columbia, Canada. We've called them, and they have not responded. We've asked how their technology works. We haven't heard back from them. But here's what they say on their website. Want to know exactly where your spouse and their cellular telephone are? If their cellular phone is turned on, we can use the cellular phone network to pinpoint the exact location of their cellular phone anywhere in the USA. Well, I'm sure people are going to be alarmed when they hear this, Andy. How much do you suspect is there of this kind of use of a cell phone, and how can they do it if the other cell phone isn't cooperating or isn't participating?
Well, there's a number of ways that you could do this. For instance, the phones themselves usually have some sort of a menu that allows you to enable this tracking. And if someone else has possession of your cell phone when the service requests to be able to track its location and they click the little OK button to do that, that means that the phone is trackable and you may not realize that that has been turned on. What the ICU service seems to be able to do, or what they promise that they can do, is that they can track you without even triggering the ability of the phone to know it's being tracked. And we really don't know exactly how they're doing that.
Right, because they're not responding. By the way, the service costs $200 to $300. Is there any way, Andy, that someone can prevent themselves from being tracked by their cell phone?
If they're using something internally at the cell phone companies to track you, as long as the phone is on and you have service, there's probably no way to avoid this.
That's Andy Brandt of PC World. When we come back, other cutting-edge cell phone technology, including will you soon carry your cell phone instead of your wallet? Use it like a credit card. Stay with us. More ahead, here and now. Talking about cell phone technology and how your mobile phone can act as a digital homing beacon, we've been talking with Andy Brandt, Senior Associate Editor for PC World. And Andy, I can imagine people getting a little nervous hearing how their cell phones can be used to track them. But some say the other side of the coin is that a cell phone is, in fact, a very secure device when it comes to saving and sharing data. So why? Why is the cell phone also very secure?
Cell phones are on a closed network. It's very difficult for hackers to poke their way around the cell phone network. So, for example, Bluetooth and Wi-Fi, which are both wireless networking technologies, there have been a number of vulnerabilities associated with them, and people are aware of this, and they're constantly poking at those things, whereas the cell phone networks as being a closed loop where just the cell phone companies use those networks, essentially it's a lot more secure.
Yeah, we're going to hear in a second about people who are using their cell phones as sort of a digital wallet, storing personal data, which we already can't know about that, but also using cell phones as credit cards.
Yeah, that's right. Cell phones are starting to become a payment mechanism in a lot of parts of the world. A Wired story based, from 1999 talked about how In Finland, you were able to dial a phone number that was on a vending machine and have the vending machine charge billed to your cell phone number. That's actually old school at this point. Now a lot of phones are being sold that have a small radio chip built into them, and all you have to do is wave the phone in front of a sensor, and that debits money from an account and allows you to buy things.
Boy, and I can't even find my messages on mine. Andy Brandt, Senior Associate Editor for PC World, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, as it turns out, one company that hopes to take cell phone technology to that European level is here in Boston. It's called Mobile Lime, L-I-M-E, and it lets people buy goods and services with their cell phones.
Welcome to Mobile Lime. Please enter the location ID. Welcome to Angora Cafe, where you can pay and save with Mobile Lime. The best wraps and frozen yogurt in Boston.
That's the message people hear on their cell phone when they dial into Mobile Lime as they prepare to order lunch at the Angora Cafe. The 10-table restaurant is a here and now favorite with its mix of Middle Eastern cuisine and guilt-free frozen yogurt. We met Mobile Lime CEO Bob Wesley for lunch.
Could I have the chicken Caesar roll-up, please?
For research purposes, I would like a vanilla ice cream cone.
I'm going to pay by Lime.
So he just held up his phone. What does that tell you?
He's going to pay by the Mobile Lime, the machine over here.
Bob has already registered with Mobile Lime, so the cashier just punches his 4-digit code into her keypad, and almost instantly a receipt prints out, and his cell phone receives a text message as confirmation.
Here's the text message. Thank you. It tells me what my balance is on my account. But I can also go home and take a look at my website, and I'll receive an email. I use that for business purposes as well.
So, I tell you what, this was pretty quick.
It's faster, and if I had a prepaid balance on my account, I'd know what my balance was before I started, so if I had to reload, I can either link any credit card, a Visa, MasterCard, American Express card, or I can set up a prepaid account, just like a Starbucks prepaid account or a gift card, where I give them money in advance.
The Angora Cafe says a lot of customers use the service, and while we were there, one diner was reading up on it, so we asked him if he'd give it a try.
Curious to know if I'm going to get random text messages and emails that I don't want or need, because I get enough spam in my inbox, I don't need it on my cell phone. As long as that's not going to happen, then I don't have a problem with it.
What are the other benefits of paying with your cell phone?
Well, the benefits is that it's a device that I always carry with me. And then it'll also tell me what the specials are. It might tell me, hey, there's a new chicken Caesar roll-up special that I might want to try, or a new sandwich product, new products, new features.
Well, that brought a question, because we understand that on the store end, this is quite a benefit, because the store now has a database of all of these cell phone users, and the store can contact you with, as you said, great deals, letting you know what the sandwiches are. They can call right to every cell phone user?
They never call me. They can send me text messages. They can send me emails. They can update me when I make a call in. And the great part is I can tell them when I want to hear from them. So I can opt out of any messages. I could opt out of a message when I receive it, or I can go to the website and set my preferences.
We've seen how even with the best intentions, databases have been stolen. Are you worried about that at all?
Of course, we're always concerned, and we always guard this information very especially. I grew up in the payment industry, spent over 20 years, and we do an extensive amount of internal security controls to make sure that the data is never lost. In fact, actually, using a transaction using a cell phone is more secure than making one with a credit card, because in a credit card situation, you reveal your financial information in the clear. Especially in a restaurant, you hand your card to a waiter and the waiter disappears. That information can be lost or stolen at that point in time. We never give out any vital information in the clear. It's always transparent to the sales staff. So we believe that we've added another level of privacy and security in the overall process.
Eat your sandwich.
Okay.
While we ate outside, Bob Wesley said he hopes that paying with your cell phone is just the beginning.
At some restaurants, they tell you not only your table's ready, but they tell you what the special is. And at one movie rental place, they're telling you that your video's overdue, but they're also telling you what the new release is. So there's a lot of ways that you can use it for customer service to enhance your overall shopping experience.
And I'm thinking, if you're waiting for a table at a restaurant, taking a walk outside, this cell phone technology would be in place of carrying one of those big pagers.
Yeah, it's also, it doesn't buzz when you get out of range. You're always in range, so it's a lot easier to carry.
That was Bob Wesley. He's CEO of Mobile Lime. 10,000 consumers have registered to use his service. It's available at 80 different merchants in Massachusetts. We visited Bob at the Angora Cafe in Boston. And this note, tomorrow on Here and Now, on the eve of the 60th anniversary of Hiroshima, we explore political forgiveness with a psychology professor who works with Catholics and Protestants in Belfast and says forgiveness isn't only healthier for individuals, it's healthier for countries. Also, propaganda films, how the U.S. portrayed the Japanese in the wake of Pearl Harbor. That's tomorrow. And stay with us, a look at the Red Sox as a religion. That's still ahead, Here and Now. At the recent World Swimming Championships in Montreal, Chinese athletes won only 5 medals, none of them gold. Now, China's been a swimming powerhouse, and the poor showing raised the suspicions of John Leonard of the American Swimming Coaches Association. In a paper entitled Fears and Facts, Leonard suggests that China has kept as many as 50 of the country's top swimmers away from international competition so that the athletes couldn't be tested for performance-enhancing drugs and could train in virtual seclusion until just before the 2008 Olympic Games. Craig Lord is swimming correspondent of the Times of London. He recently wrote a story about these claims. Only a Games Bill Littlefield asked Lord if members of the international swimming community agreed with Leonard's assertions.
Yes, I think they do. And it's not necessarily that they have some facts, but their fears they certainly have. And the whole thing is built on the huge suspicion built up because of the aberration of results and performances and the kind of seesaw hot and cold effect that we've seen from China, where one year they'll have, you know, 7 out of 10 in the world top 10 on a particular event. The next year you have to go down to 23rd to find anyone. So they're there, then they're not there, they're there, you see them, you don't, you see them, you don't. And it's that kind of pattern of behavior that makes people deeply suspicious. And the fact that when allegations like John's are made, they are serious allegations. And if they happened in America, in Britain, in Germany, you'd certainly find a lot of official people saying a lot of things about it. In China, it's kind of, well, they remain silent for the most part, and they don't seem to want to engage with the world. They're isolated, they're insular, and obviously in that kind of environment, suspicions are even deeper.
One of John Leonard's specific charges is that dozens of China's best swimmers are being kept away from international competition specifically so they can take advantage of illegal drugs and experimental procedures without fear of being tested. Has there been any proof of this?
There's absolutely no proof at all. All we do know is basically what, John has his contacts within China, and it will be very dangerous for him to reveal who the sources were for those people involved, obviously. All we do have is the following pattern, basically. We have a senior world ranking list that is kind of up and down with Chinese people and athletes, and we've had a particularly strange sort of absence of Chinese in the senior world rankings of late. But if you look down at the youth rankings, there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of very fast young Chinese kids. I'm talking between the ages of 12, 14, 15. Now, clearly, they're being prepared for a reason. So they're there on the world, on those youth rankings. Now, what these contacts in China seem to be suggesting is those are the ones you're seeing. What you're not seeing is the ones that they're keeping separate. And those we won't see until the eve of Beijing, effectively. But, of course, they have to come out 1 year before. I mean, it would be just too ridiculous for them to suddenly appear in Olympic year.
Now, you use the phrase being prepared, and, of course, the nature of the preparation is the key. Mr. Leonard says the Chinese are doing now what the East Germans were doing several decades ago. If that's true, what do you suppose leads the people breaking the rules in China now to think they won't get caught? And for China, it would be a case of being caught again.
Indeed, it would. And that is an extraordinary thing. But I have to say, when we sat in Perth, Australia, in 1998, and the news came through that enough human growth hormone had been found in the bags of one Chinese swimmer to sustain the whole of the team during their stay in Perth. You know, you're left open-mouthed by the stupidity of it. So just because you think, my God, how do they think they could possibly get away with it and how stupid would that be, doesn't mean to say that someone's not doing it. I mean, basically, you've got a situation where we know that the world, and it's not just China, we know there are people prepared to cheat in order to get that one-off result. Now, in most of our countries, it's the one-off person, the one-off cheat who's doing it individually. It's not driven by a state. It's driven by a coach and a swimmer or a coach and an athlete. This is systematic. That's the difference, that somehow, somewhere, someone is abusing children. And that is the serious nature of this allegation, is that you have a whole generation potentially being abused.
Perhaps the most ominous charge against the Chinese involves speculation that they've tried gene therapy on at least one of their swimmers, and that young man on whom they've experimented is now very ill. Have you seen any evidence of that?
Right. There were only two swimmers. When I went through this and I looked at the allegation, there were only two swimmers who fit the description. One of them, Li Zhang, actually turned up at the World Championships in Montreal and was in the final of the 1500 meters freestyle. This was a kid who came shooting up the world rankings in the year before Athens, disappeared in Athens, was nowhere. They didn't send him to the Olympics, and he didn't appear anywhere. And then this year, he suddenly reappeared. Now, he seemed perfectly healthy to me and looked very athletic indeed and a great prospect for the future. The other boy, I've never seen. I admit it. I don't know who he is. He appeared on the world rankings with a very fast time, faster than Li Zhang, at a very young age. He's called Chen Yu, and again, he's not on the world rankings this year. He has disappeared. Now, in a Western country, it's perfectly possible that a young kid, you know, can come through the rankings and then suddenly say, hey, you know what, I want to play basketball or go off and do whatever it is I want to do. In China, in a system that has a centralized control and so on, if this child is in the system, is in a sports school, he will be somewhere. Someone will know what happened to him. But when questions are put to Chinese about this, they say they have no idea. They don't know where he is. Hmm. And it's the same answer you get for people like Dai Guohong, was a world champion in 94. She came, she conquered, and she disappeared. And no one can tell you where she is now. And again, the suggestion is that she was very ill. Now, you can't back up these allegations unless you know, but you know, it is up to China, like everybody else, to answer the questions.
I guess one consequence of John Leonard's paper, Facts and Fears, could be that if some number of scientists, technicians, coaches, and swimmers are breaking the rules, they may conclude now that the world is on to them and clean up their act by 2008. Do you suppose that that's John Leonard's aim?
Yes, I'm sure it is. The point is that in the 1990s, when China suddenly appeared at the 1994 World Championships, with a group of women called the Golden Flowers, that, you know, they were sort of outsized. It was absolutely obvious to anyone who knew anything about swimming that they were cheating big time. And sure enough, a month later, on their way to the Asian Games in Hiroshima, they were pulled off a plane and seven of them tested positive for anabolic steroids. But they have gradually cleaned up their act in terms of, certainly, what they're showing to the world. Now, what John Leonard is banking on, and I think he's probably right, is that if there's enough of an outcry, then they can't possibly get away with it because people will have seen it coming. And no one can say that this has taken us by surprise. If suddenly China come up with a massive result in Beijing, everyone will accuse them in world swimming because they simply haven't had the results to back up that kind of performance.
Craig Lord is the swimming correspondent for the Times of London. He joined me from his office there. Mr. Lord, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks, Bill.
And our thanks to Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. And still to come, is Boston's Fenway Park the cathedral of a new religion? One sociologist says the Red Sox faithful's fever merges on the spiritual. You're listening to Here and Now. staying with drug use for a moment, bowing to pressure from Congress, the organization Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, or PhRMA, has issued new guidelines for prescription drug advertising. PhRMA says this code of conduct is aimed at improving what it calls the inherent educational value of advertisements. Patients, PhRMA said, need accurate and timely information and should be encouraged to discuss diseases and treatment options with their doctors. Well, will it work? Dr. Jerry Avorn is a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and author of Powerful Medicines, The Benefits, Risks, and Costs of Prescription Drugs, and he recently spoke with Here and Now's Bob Oakes.
Doctor, talk about the timing of this, if you would. The drug companies didn't have to do this, come out with these guidelines. It's a voluntary code of conduct, but it does come amid increased pressure and scrutiny of the industry.
Well, in a sense, they did have to do it in a political way because we've got Senator Frist and Senator Grassley who are being quite critical of what the industry has been doing with direct-to-consumer ads. And I guess their sense was that they had better appear to be doing something before there's regulation that is enforced on them.
So how are the ads going to change?
Hardly at all. If you really read the guidelines, it is striking how little difference there is from what we currently have. There may be fewer of these little 15-second kind of useless little reminder ads, but besides that, we're told that the ads will have balance in that they will talk about risks as well as benefits, and that's a little worrisome because if that's the new guidelines, what does it mean they were doing before? I guess the other change is they said they're going to pay better attention to what time ads run in light of their content, so maybe we'll see fewer ads for erectile dysfunction drugs during the World Series during the daytime. But then again, that's just kind of common sense and common decency. It's surprising they need a guideline for that.
So if the ads aren't going to change much, will there be any benefit, real benefit, to consumers on the other end of the ads?
I don't think so. I think the industry wanted to appear to be doing something, wanted to appear to be policing itself. But indeed, we're not going to see a curbing of the biggest problems we have, which is this is $4 billion a year that ultimately consumers are paying for to be, through their drug prices, to be told to use a given product with really minimal information about what the products do. And that's not going to change.
One of the guidelines, as I understand it, calls for the companies to educate health professionals about new drugs. One would have thought they were doing that already.
Exactly. It's another one of those saying that one would do things that one's already doing. I guess the other component of that is that they say that they will do so before turning on the spigot on the direct-to-consumer ads, but they don't want to be bound by any particular duration before the ads appear for the public. I think really what that's about is the doctors were getting angry that their patients were coming in telling them about drugs they'd seen in ads before the doctors had heard about the ads themselves, about the drugs themselves. So that's really also very much in their self-interest.
The drug industry spent $4 billion on direct advertising to consumers last year. In a recent column, you wrote that one drug ad actually highlights the bottom line, saying, quote, today's medicines finance tomorrow's miracles. And I'm wondering, how does that kind of thinking influence research into new drugs and regulation of how they're marketed?
Well, that tagline in the ads from one of the companies essentially says, we want to charge you a lot for your medicine so that we can do research to discover new medicines. And we've been hearing that for a while from industry. The problem is that they're spending way more on advertising and promotion than they're spending on research. And if only they were spending a larger fraction of that promotional budget on research, maybe the drug pipeline would not be as barren as it is for most of the large companies. So I think we need to be careful not to be sucked into the idea of let us advertise to you a lot, let us charge more than any other country in the world pays for drugs, and we'll discover new drugs for you, because they frankly haven't been doing such a great job with their pipelines.
And so therefore, do you think that the volume of ads that we're seeing on TV are only going to increase under these new guidelines?
Yeah, the advertising does seem to work, especially for drugs that don't do anything terribly important, and that you can market almost to an unlimited audience, like the pills for heartburn. It's gold mine for the companies because everybody's had heartburn, and if you can use a direct-to-consumer ad to get a patient to convince their doctor to write them a prescription that's going to cost somebody $1,000 or more a year, then that's a great economic strategy for the company. So I expect we're going to be seeing more and more, but at a time that we can barely afford to pay for the drugs we have, it's not clear that that's in the public's interest.
That's Dr. Jerry Avorn of Harvard Medical School speaking to Here and Now's Bob Oakes. Stay with us. Much more ahead, Here and Now. Mm-hmm.
souvenir program $2.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. If you haven't noticed, the Red Sox are in first place in the American League East. So now the fans get to experience something new. How to approach World Series season after you've won one, something they did for the first time in 86 years last fall. Well, one of the first things you do, make a pilgrimage to Fenway Park.
I just think it's like kind of like a cornerstone of Boston, you know? It's kind of like the bottom brick, you know, it's a pillar. It's without Fenway Park, Boston wouldn't be what it is today.
Fenway is the home. It's intricately intertwined with who the Red Sox are. It's their base. It's the history. It's location in downtown Boston. I just feel like there's a real unity about being with other people and being at Fenway Park, and it's special.
It's part of who you are. When you come from Boston, you're a Sox fan. It is who you are.
I kind of dream about the ballpark. I have this obsession with Fenway Park, and if I had my way, when I die, I'd be buried out there. I know you can't do that, but sure, why not?
So what is it about Fenway Park at 93, the oldest park in baseball? Well, Michael Borer has spent a great deal of time thinking about Red Sox fans and their affinity for Fenway Park and the Green Monster, the nickname for the left field wall. He recently earned his doctorate in sociology from Boston University, his dissertation, Playing with Tradition, Fenway Park and Urban Culture. And he joins us on the line now with more. Michael, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Good. You talk about the importance of Fenway Park as a third place. Remind us what that is.
Well, third place is essentially a place where people go to be with other people between work and home. Generally, third places tend to be local neighborhood places like a local tavern or coffee shop, where people go to socialize,
right,
to be social, to be around other people. Now, what's fascinating about Fenway Park is it functions like a third place for the entire city.
Well, sometimes it functions like a big darn third tavern.
But that's true.
How important is place to sociologists like yourself? And why, you know, what sparked this interest in Fenway, other than the obvious love that many have for the park?
Well, I think the importance of place, or looking at the importance of place, can tell us a lot about what people revere, what people believe in. More importantly, how place is important for them, for people in cities in particular. Places are where culture is empirically located. Important third places and big third places like Fenway Park provide mediums for the negotiation of civic culture, for the construction, the maintenance of it, the reconstruction of it.
Tell us some of the things that happen at Fenway when the Sox aren't there.
Well, that was one of the things that really interested me about Fenway, what happens the rest of the time. And frankly, a lot happens. Now the tours are offered all year round. They've also opened up the ballpark to celebrate civic holidays like Halloween or Mother's Day or Father's Day, where fathers and sons and fathers and daughters and mothers and daughters and mothers and sons can actually go out and have a catch on the sacred ground.
So Fenway Park is bringing people in for more just plain community events, but people are also taking Fenway Park to their homes, literally. You talk about these shrines that are popping up.
Well, this, I think, is absolutely fascinating, where people aren't necessarily just accepting Fenway Park as something that's given to them, as something that's out there. They're appropriating it for their own purposes. So people have built backyard faux Fenways, for mini Fenways, for wiffle ball games, community games, for their family. I have to ask the question, what is going on here? Rather than just take it for granted, like, oh, yeah, Fenway Park, it's an old ballpark, it's great. Well, what else is going on here? And more importantly, what can this tell us about the way that people live in cities?
And what did you find? What is going on?
What I set out to do was talk to people and hear their stories about Fenway Park. And as the argument goes, good stories make good communities or good cities. Now, people use Fenway Park as a character in many of the stories that they tell about themselves and about their city. They also include Fenway Park like an old friend, in their most significant moments in their life. There's birth rituals, there's marriage rituals, there's also death rituals. I talked with a few people who had stories about people going to the ballpark and sprinkling ashes. Mm. I mean, this is more than just a ballpark.
Well, and that brings to mind the question. You say Fenway Park, a third place, a communal place, a civic place. Mm-hmm. Is it a religious place? You, we should say, had a minor in religion at Lafayette College and a master's degree in religious studies from BU, in addition to your sociology doctorate. Is Fenway Park a religion or a religious place?
Well, that's a big question and can sometimes be a touchy question. Now, what I think is really interesting, or one of the things I found, was the way that people can display dual identities at the ballpark. And what I mean by that, people from diverse populations come into Fenway Park and are Red Sox fans. But they're not just Red Sox fans, and I think this is the nature of modern individual and also the nature of modern religion as well, or modern urban religion, in that it can be a hybrid of a number of different types of ideas, different types of identities, different cultures, for that matter, or different belief systems. So one example pops into my mind where I saw this young Jewish boy, must have been about 8 or 9 years old, and he had a navy blue yarmulke. And on one side it had a red B, and on the other side it had two red socks. So here he was displaying his allegiance both to Judaism as well as to the Red Sox. And so I bring this up because when we think of religion, well, you can only really have one, right, in the traditional sense. Well, maybe this is marking some sort of new type of emergent religion where people can pick and choose. And we've seen that in other instances as well.
So it's sort of a civic religion.
Yeah, we could preface it with civic, but I don't want that to take away from the reverence, the fervent religiosity of Red Sox, quote-unquote, nation.
Right. And again, a religion that can welcome anyone from any religious background and has less to do with any biblical works. It's sort of, what is it, a modern day, what is it?
Well, we go to the ballpark and we see myths come alive. We take part in rituals before the game, after the game, during the game. Mm-hmm. And I think if people are calling it sacred, if people are speaking of Ted Williams or David Ortiz's godlike plays, and et cetera, I think we need to take that seriously.
Yeah. As a sociologist, are you curious as to how the perennial losers, the Red Sox fans, are now going to approach another World Series as the winners, the title holders? It's a whole different thing now.
Exactly. And I think this feeds into exactly what I'm saying about Fenway Park, that it provides a medium for the negotiation of those identities. Because I think people are going to the ballpark this year. The Red Sox are charging the same price for the obstructed view tickets this year, which they hadn't done in the past. And people are going and they're loving it. They're loving it. And they're loving sitting in the seats that face the wrong way and the seats that they need to squeeze into. And they love every moment of it. It's really pretty remarkable.
Michael Bohr wrote his dissertation, Playing with Tradition, Fenway Park, and Urban Culture, for his doctorate in sociology from Boston University. He's currently teaching at Furman University in South Carolina, where they're building a new ballpark with a replica of the Green Monster in the outfield. Thanks for speaking with us. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now. Go Sox.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. Join us.